This is day six of this July 2014 seven-day session. And today we'll comment on a koan in the Mumon Kan, number six. The Buddha holds up a flower. And first, I'll just read the case. Once when the world honored one, in ancient times, was upon Vulture Peak, he held up a flower before the assembly of monks. At this, all were silent. The venerable Kashyapa alone broke into a smile. The world honored one said, I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable Nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the sutras. I now hand it on to Mahakashyapa. This case, number six, is based on a famous story. That's what the case is, the story. Some have called it a fable. It's not, never really happened. But it doesn't matter in terms of its value as a koan, whether it has historical veracity or not. Is not important. It's a good koan. About Mahakashyapa, he with this incident of him smiling on Vulture Peak in response to the Buddha holding up a flower, he became the first, it's called the first patriarch of Zen. As a monk, he was renowned for. I'm reading now from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. He was renowned for his ascetic self-discipline and moral strictness, and. Thanks to these qualities, he took over leadership of the Sangha after the death of the Buddha. Oh, excuse me, he's considered the first patriarch of Zen. I said that, okay. And then there's a passage here. At the first Buddhist council, which Mahakashyapa convoked in order to counteract tendencies toward a less strict lifestyle within the Sangha, differences of opinion arose between him and Ananda, another principal disciple of the Buddha. Ananda was told not to, he was not permitted to attend the council because he had not yet attained arhathood, enlightenment. Mahakashyapa also accused him of having favored the founding of the order of nuns and of not having asked the Buddha for precise instructions concerning the elimination of certain disciplinary rules. Mahakashyapa also accused Ananda of not having supplicated the Buddha to prolong his earthly existence. These are just old texts these are based on. In Chinese temples and in our own Buddha Hall in Rochester, the Mahakashyapa is shown to the Buddha's right and Ananda to the Buddha's left. Iconographically, Mahakashyapa is often identified by his very cracked, wrinkled face because of his age and his asceticism. Now that's from the the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. Now I'm going to turn to a different source, actually a collection of koans called The Transmission of Light, Denko Roku in Japanese. And this is alleged ancestral line in Zen. It has little stories about in enlightenment accounts of each of these 52 or so early masters. So now reading under Kashyapa. Kashyapa is, well, the same as Mahakashyapa. The Maha means great, large, and it's an honorific. It says Kashyapa was born in a Brahmin family. He's of course Indian. In Sanskrit, Kashyapa means drinker of light. When he was born, a golden light filled the room, then went into his mouth. Hence he was called Kashyapa, drinker of light. His complexion was golden, and he had 30 of the 32 major marks of greatness. This is an old idea that a Buddha had the 32 marks of greatness, and here Kashyapa, they say, has had 30. Kashyapa met the Buddha at a shrine known as the Shrine of Many Children. The Buddha said, "Welcome, mendicant." And so at that point, Kashyapa had already shaved his head and put on a patchwork robe. It says Kashyapa practiced austerities and never wasted any time. Remember that the Buddha started off his journey to enlightenment by first spending 6 years practicing austerities, severe austerities, and then he gave it up when he realized it would not lead to his goal of enlightenment. Well, in that sense, Kashyapa had come a similar route. And it says here, only seeing the ugly emaciation of his body and the wretchedness of his clothing, everyone doubted Kashyapa. So everyone, the Sangha, apparently the Buddha had warned them that self-punishment was not the way. Everyone doubted Kashyapa. Because of this, every time the Buddha was going to give a talk in some place or other, he shared his seat with Kashyapa, who thenceforth was the senior member of the community. We'll return to this text, the transmission of light, a little later, but let's wade into the case. Once when the world honored one, this became the standard way of referring to the Buddha. Most of you know that from having heard texts using that name. Once when the world honored one in ancient times was upon Vulture Peak. Vulture Peak was one of the sites that my little group of pilgrims visited the first time I went to India, myself and three other staff members from Rochester. We put that on our agenda, and I was really glad that we did, because it was so so primeval. We had just spent some days at Bodh Gaya, the seat of the Buddha's enlightenment, and by contrast, Bodh Gaya was kind of a Times Square of Buddhist pilgrimage sites. Just so many hundreds of Buddhists from all kinds of different countries, wearing different kinds of robes, monks and lay people, and a lot noisier than we had been led to expect. And then when we left there, we took a taxi. It was cheap enough with four people dividing the fare. We took a taxi to this Mount Rudrakuta. We usually just use the translation Vulture Peak. And we had it to ourselves. It was just a kind of a low mountain. Most of it was wooded. I don't remember many details. This was 35 years ago. But we just relished the silence and the solitude there, having it to ourselves and just wandering around, and then standing on the rock where the Buddha reportedly sat and held up the flower. At the time, there was a Nichiren temple that had been built nearby, a pagoda, actually. And that was about it. Everything else was, there were no signs. There must have been a sign or two just to identify that site as the place where this happened. So I really have the grateful for being able to picture this, the context, the surroundings of this scene. He held up a flower before the assembly of monks. Tradition tells us that sometimes hundreds of monks would gather to hear the Buddha speak. But he began by just holding up this flower. Some versions say that he twirled the flower a little bit. And the venerable Kashyapa alone broke into a smile. Back to the transmission of light. It says here that it begins, that this little chapter on Kashyapa begins, when the Buddha raised a flower and blinked his eyes, Kashyapa broke out in a smile. It's actually the first time I'd ever read about the blinking was from this source. And then later in this chapter, the author of this collection of koans, it's attributed to Japanese Zen master Keizan, who was the Dharma successor of Dogen. It says, Leaving aside the raising of the flower for the moment, everyone should clearly understand the blinking of the eyes. You raise your eyebrows and blink your eyes in the ordinary course of things, and Buddha blinked his eyes when he raised the flower. These are not separate at all. Your talking and smiling and Kashyapa's breaking into a smile are not different at all. And then, after Kashyapa alone smiled, all the others were silent, the World Honored One approved. He gave his sanctioning. He said, "I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the sutras. I now hand it on to Mahakashyapa." This first phrase, when the Buddha said, "I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma," this is the eye of the true Dharma is the English version of the Shobogenzo, this great work by Zen Master Dogen. Eye of the true Dharma. The Dharma. Dharma is the original word that then in China became Tao, T-A-O, Tao, the way. Secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. And then this final line, "It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the sutras." This became the sort of designation for the Zen sect. It is a teaching that does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the sutras. In the late Aitken Roshi's commentary on this koan, he refers to a distinction made by, I'm afraid I forget who it was, philosopher or educator, a distinction between two kinds of communication. One is presentational communication and the other is discursive communication. Discursive is what we mostly think of as communication, ordinary explanatory words. Presentational communication can be with words, but it is more direct. The koans are full of presentations, the shout, the striking of the stick, gute, sticking up a finger, and on it goes. And this is what we find we more easily move toward through as our practice moves on, that we can, there's plenty we can communicate with through movement, simple, declarative speech in a word or two or five. When when we bow in the Doksan room, we're communicating through presentation. Every once in a while, someone, as they're leaving the Doksan room, will say, thank you. But your bow is saying that. It's redundant to say it. And the bow says it more eloquently than any words. To respond when someone calls you, yes, is a presentation. It's a presentation of if it's immediate with no gap, that's a presentation of an empty mind, a mind of readiness and awareness. When the Buddha held up the flower, he was presenting what Hakuin said centuries later when Hakuin said, I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth. I am the flower, he's saying. All beings are this flower. In a book called The Man Who Killed the Deer, Frank Waters puts it this way: nothing is simple and alone. We are not separate and alone. The breathing mountains, the living stones, each blade of grass, the clouds, the rain, each star, the beasts and the invisible spirits of the air, we are all one, indivisible. So I would have you look upon this thing not as a separate, simple thing, but as a stone, which is a star in the firmament of earth, as a ripple in a pool, as a kernel of corn. I would have you consider how it fits into the whole, how far its influence may spread, what it may grow into. Well, the influence of this holding up the flower and perhaps even more importantly, the smile in response grew into then after Mahakashyapa, Ananda, and then on and on and on, right down to our present time, just with the flower and the smile. Roshi Kaplo used to comment, a flower smiles, a smile flowers. In Doksan, of course, the student has to demonstrate her or his understanding of what happened here on Vulture Peak. Without an explanation, he or she has to present, not explain. We'll go right on to the commentary, Mumon's commentary. It's a pretty long one. Golden-faced Kudon is certainly outrageous. He turns the noble into the lowly and sells dog flesh advertised as sheep's head, though with some genius. However, supposing that at the time all the monks had smiled, how would the all-including eye of the true Dharma have been handed on? Or again, if Kashyapa had not smiled, how could he have been entrusted with it? If you say that the true Dharma can be handed on anyway, the golden-faced old man with his loud voice deceived the simple villagers. If you say it can't be transmitted, why did Buddha say he had handed it on to Kashyapa? Well, here we have Mumon at his best in toying with the monks and even present-day readers, starting with his wry poke at the Buddha. We see this all through the Mumon Khan, where, and not just the Mumon Khan, in Zen generally, where the masters will deliberately bring their predecessors down to earth with these earthy, seemingly somewhat belittling comments. Here I can picture these ancient villages where the only entertainment they ever had was some impresario, some extrovert gathering a crowd and a loud voice, getting their attention and telling stories or somehow presenting. And then in usual course of things, I would pass around a hat or a basket and make some money this way. Golden-faced Kudon. Kudon is some nickname for the Buddha. Is certainly outrageous. He turns the noble into the lowly and sells dog flesh advertised as sheep's head. The noble into the lowly. The Sanskrit word for noble is Arya. And it was often was a modifier for the Sangha. The noble Sangha, the Arya Sangha. How did the Buddha turn the noble into the lowly here? And the dog flesh advertised as sheep's head. I think everyone can see the advertising in the case. A lot of text there to put a gloss on this simple matter of a flower. And then he poses this mischievous question. What if all the monks, hey, wait a minute, what if they all had smiled? What, Buddha would have been at a loss then. We might not be here if everyone had smiled. And what about if Kashyapa had not smiled? Mumon is dangling these hypotheticals in front of us, as he often does, to try to throw sand in our eyes, get the discriminating mind and overdrive and pondering these things. But there is valuable point that we can come to about transmission. In Zen, this what we call Dharma transmission is really what it comes down to is when the teacher feels the student is in accord with his own understanding. The student's understanding is reached an accord with his or her own. In Japan, they took it further and said that to give Dharma transmission, the student's understanding has to exceed the teacher's understanding. But we don't need to take that literally. If that were the case, then today any teacher would have understanding, would dwarf the understanding of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. But the point is that successive generations of photocopies, if the transmission is not true, if the student does not qualify for the transmission truly, then what you have is the decline of the tradition, which of course is what's happening. Most Zen teachers today don't require even having seen into that the student have seen into her true nature in order to receive Dharma transmission. I know some of you heard me say this many times. I'm still floored by it, that they don't even claim to have that as a requirement. I fished a story out of this wonderful book called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. It's short. The Zen master Munan sent for his disciple Shoju one day and said, "I am an old man now, Shoju, and it is you who will carry on this teaching. Here is a book that has been handed down for seven generations from master to master. I have myself added some notes to it that you will find valuable. Here, keep it with you as a sign that I have made you my successor." And at that, Shoju burned it immediately. Just as Mumon is dangling this question about this hypothetical question about transmission, what if everyone had smiled? What if Kashyapa had not smiled? We can see the Buddha's reference to the all-pervading eye, the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form, as also kind of a goad to us to see through all that conceptual language, so that we're not attached to the idea of it, and that instead we will experience what it's pointing to. There's a story of the great Nanshuan, known in Japanese as Nansen, a Tang Dynasty master who was out working in the garden, and a disciple came to him and asked him, what is the way of Nanshuan? In other words, show me your understanding. What is your teaching? And Nanshuan held up the sickle, the garden tool he had been using, just held it up. And the disciple said, I'm asking about the way of Nanshuan, not the sickle. And Nanshuan said, I can use it with pleasure. Either his holding up the sickle went right over the head of this disciple, or the disciple was just pressing him, seeing what he would do next. In any case, he was beautifully demonstrating the way of Nanshuan and holding up that sickle, holding up a stick. Because transmission has become so unreliable, that is, the criteria for transmission have become so unreliable, we look to the authorized one, look to his or her teacher to get some sense, and that teacher's teacher as one way to evaluate the validity of one's authorization to teach. Now the verse, holding up a flower, the snake shows its tail. Kashyapa smiles, and people and devas are confounded. Holding up a flower, the snake shows its tail. Who's the snake in this, showing its tail? What's Mumon talking about? The snake shows its tail. When we were kids, we had the family dog for quite a few years, was a dachshund, and Heidi would sometimes get into some mischief, get up on the counter or something and get her nose into a cake or some other food, and when we were away, and then we'd come back and she would scurry under the dining room table where there was a tablecloth for a period of time. The tablecloth came down to the floor almost, and she would hide under the table, but her little tail would be sticking out there. Thinking that she could keep this secret to herself. Kashyapa smiles, and people and devas are confounded. People and devas became a conventional way of referring to... Well, it's the two highest realms of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Those are the two highest, humans and devas, in most formulations. And so I guess the idea was that people and devas pretty much comprised all of those who, with a shot at understanding things of this nature, people of those who have risen to a level of consciousness where they could benefit from hearing the Dharma. So Kashyapa smiles, people and devas are confounded. Why are people, let's just stick to people, why are people confounded at this teaching that is a no teaching? This Dharma that is a no Dharma. Why are people confounded with the koan they're working on? Even the breath practice they have. We complicate things. We complicate things unnecessarily through our thought processes, or more correctly, our clinging to our thoughts, instead of just looking directly. Kashyapa just looked directly at that flower. He saw. And he could have had no thoughts in his mind at the time. Kashyapa could not have been thinking for a second about getting anything out of that flower or coming to awakening. His mind had to have been as pure as a white sheet of paper, completely free of thoughts, concepts, notions, hopes, expectations, regrets, certainly free of thoughts of self. It had to have been free of thoughts of self and the self's ambitions and progress or any other such nonsense. Takes absolute devotion to one's practice to reach this state of purity of mind, emptiness of mind. Even now, most people's minds are much more empty than they were earlier in Sesshin, much more so. The clouds are getting very thin. Clouds of thought are thinning out, getting very light. Some people will be satisfied with the buoyancy, the feeling of buoyancy and freedom, the lightness, even the joy, the quiet joy. Other people will not be. Most people will be. That's the truth. Based on all past experience, most people will be grateful for what they've gotten out of the Sesshin so far. And then, after Sesshin, this feeling will pass. Others, mostly those who have seen this buoyancy and quiet joy, have seen it pass after Sesshin enough times, will not be satisfied with this elevated state. They will continue to grapple with the koan or get deeper into the practice, whatever it is, knowing that this is where our efforts will bring the greatest results. This is when, because the mind is so concentrated now, relative to normal states of mind, because we are at the top of our game, everyone, really, no matter what you think your condition of your mind is, it doesn't get much better than this. And because of that, the readiness of the mind, then this is where we have the best opportunity to wipe away those last wisps of cloud. Not by trying to wipe them away, not doing anything with the thoughts, but just going the final, final little leap beyond this ordinary mind and reaching complete oneness with the practice. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.